At a conference called Life After Capitalism, what does discussing life after capitalism have to do with accomplishing anything in the present, which, after all, is what we have to do, accomplish things now? I think the answer is that vision, an understanding of where it is that we want to try and get to, can inform what we're doing, our direction, can give us hope, can give us a reason for our activism. Yet it's many activists, not the ones here, and not the ones who put together these events, but many activists don't have time for vision. They feel it sort of gets in the way of getting on with the business of today. Imagine I was to get up, and I was to give the most powerful, moving, emotional, gut-wrenching speech you'd ever heard. I describe a phenomenon that is so destructive that it limits and it constrains and it narrows our lives, and finally it kills us, one after another of us. And at the end of this talk, and the evidence is just irrefutable, I say, come join me in a social movement against aging. You would think I was crazy. You would think, what are you talking about? But my evidence would be valid. I would have made a compelling and absolutely irrefutable case that this phenomenon rips our lives apart and constrains us and diminishes us over time and eventually kills us. Nonetheless, when I said join a social movement against us, you might say, get a life, grow up, face reality, right? Start to pay attention to the way things are. Things that I bet all of you have heard when you talk about poverty or racism or sexism or war or imperialism. And I think the people who say those things to us often have the exact same thing in their head. There is no alternative. There's no point in blowing into the wind. There's no point in forming a movement against gravity. There's no point in forming a movement against poverty and war and racism and so on, because these things are, Tina, they are inevitable. There is no alternative. They are a part of reality. So I admire the effort to get together and to try and talk about, among other things, not exclusively, but among other things, what it is that we want and what is a viable alternative to the system we live under. For me, life after capitalism means that we'd have to come up with a set of institutions to replace the institutions that are central to capitalism. Those institutions are private ownership, profit-seeking, markets, corporate divisions of labor, remunerating people for their power, for their property, even for their output. Those are the institutions that are central to the thing called capitalism. It's not just that capitalism is theft, a very famous expression. Actually, it comes out of the anarchist heritage, I believe, that represents an understanding that there's something about capitalism that causes people's capacities to be ripped off on behalf of a few. It's not just that. Capitalism is also indignity. It's the indignity of blind obedience. It's the indignity of people having to obey orders that are imposed from above. In corporations in the United States, it's often the case that workers have to ask to go to the bathroom. Stalin never dreamed, in his most violent, aggressive moment, of imposing upon a population a regimen in which you would have to ask permission to go to the bathroom. But it's typical in American corporations. It's typical in institutions that are typical of capitalism. So capitalism is that kind of indignity. Capitalism is the subordination of the great many to a tiny few. About 20% of our population have a considerable say in the economic decisions that affect their lives and other people's lives. But about 80% of us simply have to follow orders and fulfill roles in slots that are designed by others for the benefit of others. Capitalism is gargantuan riches and gluttony alongside massive poverty and starvation. At this moment in the United States, there are roughly 7 million empty hotel rooms. There are also roughly 7 million people sleeping under bridges, homeless. At this moment in the United States, there are about 30 million people below the poverty line. Bill Gates' private wealth is roughly comparable to the private wealth of every individual that lives in Norway added together. Capitalism is gargantuan riches alongside inequality and starvation. Capitalism is greedy corporate globalization rather than caring internationalism. It's a process of international organization that tilts the playing field of cultural and political and economic intercourse, international exchange, so that the benefits accrue overwhelmingly to the already wealthy and the already powerful. Corporate globalization is just making that tilt even worse and worse. Our internationalism should tilt it in the opposite direction so that the benefits benefit those who are poorer and weaker more. But capitalism is the former. Capitalism is war and occupation rather than peace. It leads to governments being willing to engage in activities that have the potential, and sometimes do, kill, maim, and exile thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. So capitalism is something we have to get beyond. And for those on the left who are revolutionary, we believe there is something beyond capitalism. But for many people, capitalism and racism and sexism and political authoritarianism are things that seem to them like gravity and are providing a vision of what is better, of what would deliver a better life, is necessary to overcome that kind of cynicism, that kind of lack of faith in the possibility of doing something. So addressing life after capitalism and life after racism and life after sexism and life after authoritarianism seem to me to be critically important questions, critically important endeavors for us to do. For me, I happen to spend a lot of time working on economics because of my background, and the economic vision that sustains a lot of my activity is called participatory economics, and it roughly has four guiding values: solidarity, equity, diversity, and self-management. Solidarity just means an economy should cause us to care about one another instead of be a rat race in which even the winners are rats. It should cause us to care about one another instead of trampling one another. Diversity means that an economy should yield diverse outcomes. It should yield a wide range of choices and options and of experiments and of explorations instead of homogenizing results. Equity means that an economy should reward people for the work, the duration of the work they do, the intensity of the work they do, and the onerousness of the work they do. But not for owning property, not for having a piece of paper in their pocket. That's why Bill Gates is worth more than the population of Norway. Not for output, not for bargaining power. We shouldn't have an economy that's basically the economy of a thug, in which you get more if you can take more. That's actually what we have. To fulfill those core institutions, those core values, I think we need new institutions. I'm going to talk about this a lot on Sunday, so I'm not going to talk about it in any great detail now. I think it means workers and consumers' councils. I think it means self-managed decision-making. That's the fourth value. We should have a say in the decisions that impact our lives in proportion to the degree that they do so. That's quite different from anything, even from representative democracy, of which we have a facsimile, I suppose you could say, in the United States at best. I think we need remuneration for effort and sacrifice. I think we need balanced job complexes to replace the corporate division of labor. That is, we need a way of working, of dividing up our work that gives us all comparably empowering circumstances, comparably fulfilling conditions in the work that we do. What about gender? I don't know. I think we need a gender vision. 30 years ago, the women's movement was starting to ask questions like, what is it? What is it in social relations which creates a distinction between men and women, which causes a hierarchy between them? Many women thought that maybe it was mothering and fathering. That was an idea that was emerged. The idea that men father and women mother, and that those roles are different, tended in many people's minds to reproduce a sexual division of labor and a sexual hierarchy and a gender hierarchy. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's something else. I think we need to say, we need to explore it, we need to be able to have a vision for gender. We need to be able to have a vision for how cultural communities can interact together respectfully, retaining their autonomy, retaining their dignity, not at war. Maybe it's called multiculturalism, maybe it's called intercommunalism, but we need to be able to express it. In the political realm, there's going to be legislation. There's going to be adjudication of disputes. There's going to be shared program. It is not enough to say, we don't want a state. What we don't want is an oppressive, authoritarian, imposing, coercive state. But there will be political institutions. And so I think we need a political vision for how these political functions are accomplished. The problem that arises is how to win this movement. I really do want to stick to my, or this new world, I want to really stick to my time because I am going to speak a lot over the weekend. I want to just talk about one point. Some years ago I was on a panel, somebody was giving a talk about characteristics of our movement, and a thought sort of flashed through my mind. I asked myself, what would happen if all the people from when I got started, let's say from 1965, a little before when I got started, to now, who became part of the left, or who got into the vicinity of the left, right? People who were in the anti-war movements, the no-nukes movements, the civil rights movements, the women's movements, the gay movement, and so on and so forth, the labor movement. People who took courses from leftists, people who came in the vicinity of the left. If all the people who came in the vicinity of the left, or even a large percentage of them, had, by virtue of the left being, as we're supposed to be, more humane, more caring, more able to create an environment that's fulfilling and rewarding, became more and more attached to the left, more and more committed to the left. If there was a stickiness, if it was like gravity, if people, when they became near the left, got more and more involved in it, cared more and more about it, became more and more committed to it, I asked myself how many leftists there'd be. How many, if this was the case, if this was a characteristic of our movement, that it was sticky, how many of us would there be now? And I thought about it for a while, and I decided there were probably 10 million people, very conservatively, who would come into that position. And if 7 million of them had stuck and were organizing others to stick, we'd have a powerful, at least progressive, probably revolutionary movement in the United States, including 30 or 40 million people. And I almost fell out of my chair. Because this, the obstacle to this, the reason we don't have this, isn't really, I don't think, that they have a lot of guns. It isn't that they have the media. It isn't any of that. It's that the movements that we build are not conducive enough to people feeling good, to people feeling empowered, for them to stay and feel more and more and more involved. And that, to me, says something about another part of our agenda. I think our agenda should be to address this problem. And I just want to say one last thing about how we do it. One way we do it, I think we know. We learned 30 years ago from the civil rights movement, from the black movement and the Latino movement, that you can't have a movement that's racist and have a movement that is congenial to and empowering to its members, and particularly its members of you know, racially oppressed communities. You can't do it. It's hypocritical. It won't have good politics in those areas. It will not lead those constituencies to say. And then the women's movement taught the same thing. You can't have a movement that is sexist in its internal division of labor. You can't have one that has Jim Crow relations. And you can't have one that looks like the Playboy Club, right? Or a professional football team. You can't have one that embodies sexist norms and have it be conducive to people staying. Well, I think there's another line. I think both of those things are true. And I think to a considerable extent, that message has been heard and people try to deal with it. It's hard. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. But much, much progress has been made. I promise you, I was there then and now, and much progress has been made, even though there's more still to make. But there's another axis on which this same issue arises. If we have movements whose internal structure is like that of the institutions we're opposing, is class divided, has people who give orders and who take orders, have people who have corner offices and people who do shit work, has people who get higher income and people who get lower income, if our movement organizations essentially are barely distinguishable in their list of offices and the characteristics of those positions from the ones that we oppose, just like if it's Jim Crow, Jim Crow, sexism, sexism, it will not be conducive to working people. It will not be empowering to working people. And it won't be all that uplifting, and it won't embody something that gives us a belief that there really is an alternative and makes us stick to it. So it seems to me we have to address that too. I think it's true of culture too. The culture of the movement once upon a time was totally macho. It was totally white. And it embodied the worst of that. It embodied the sexism and the racism of that. And there's been an effort to deal with it, but it hasn't been totally successful, but it's progressing. But there's also a sense in which our movement also feels like the Yale Law School, not like a working class pub. It values things that law students value, that people who want to fill those slots in society value, and it disparages things that working people value. Those ills are also a powerful impediment, I think probably a much, much more powerful impediment than the riot club or the gun, to our building a movement that can win. And that's a lucky thing, because it's in our power to do something about these obstacles to growth. And I think when we do something about these obstacles to growth, we will have still larger, still stronger movements that can win a series of changes, that can develop a movement structure, and that can not only make people's lives better in the present, but can lead to fundamentally different institutions, to revolutionarily different institutions in a future that needn't be all that far off. Thank you.